Yeah, I had an idea in mind, and I my ideal was the Brandeis method, which was something I could never perfect. But I always remembered two things in writing, three things. First thing is that you got to learn very early that the limitations on review, everything that comes up to the court has some limit on it, either a judicially imposed limitation on review or a legislatively imposed limitation on review. What do you do when you're reviewing a decision of the Workers' Compensation Appeal Board? There's a standard of review there. What do you do if you're reviewing what used to be called an equity case, an old chancery case? It's de novo, used to be de novo. In cases involving simple lawsuits, you were looking at assignments of error. Unemployment compensation cases, another standard of review coming from the appeal board. So the first thing you learn is that there's limitation on review. And a good conscientious judge may have all kinds of feelings about the subject matter, but you look at your review limits, number one. Number two, something I had to learn the hard way, because I was so awfully afraid of hurting somebody by being mistaken, that I used to just worry over decisions, and realizing that they're going to be used as precedent perhaps for many years to come, that I would just work until I would get myself into frazzle in my first year or so on the court. To tell you the truth, I wasn't very productive. The record would show that. Not my first year or two. No, you don't want to confuse me with Talbot Smith, because I succeeded him, and because his name was Smith, very often people will look at his work, which is quite distinctive from mine. Talbot was an exquisite, highly stylized legal writer. I wrote plainly because, as I said, I read something that Brandeis said, never consider that you have fashioned the immanent rule, immanent rule, which is the living rule beyond which no other rule can even approach. He said the burden is yet to be borne. So you do your very best with what you got, number two. And the third thing is that you seek clarity. Having been exposed to journalism at Syracuse and having started out life to be a journalist, I thought I would not want to write long, compound, complex sentences. That I would write shorter sentences and strive for clarity and simplicity, because Brandeis, quote, when we get cute, he would say, somebody gets hurt. And I was keenly aware that people who wrote in a highly stylized fashion, unless you happen to have been somebody like Cardoza, who could write and did write in the grand style, as we call it, the ordinary judge just didn't have that kind of talent. So what you want to do is decide it as simply as possible, so that the lawyers and judges who've got to follow it are looking at something fairly simple and just fitted for that occasion, something that they can interpret and apply with minimum effort. The ringing phrases, the highly stylized adjectives just screw up the works and make it different to follow. You're right, I try to write plainly. Another thing I would do in very big cases, I'm thinking about the Fenestra case and a few others I wrote that were very, very big cases, they had huge records. It took an awful long time to wade through a 13-week trial record. On the big cases, I would set out the various segments of the opinion, facts, and I would confine my statement of facts to the section marked statement of facts. I would take up the issues seriatim, and I would label the head of that section, this is, you know, whatever the issue was, legal issue, and I would confine my discussion of that legal issue to that section for clarity's sake, simplicity's sake. And that's what I followed.
Mm-hmm. Now, I found as I riffled through, I thought, an astonishing succession of cases where you were the author of the case, and I'm talking about your cases in that sense, and they were unanimous, or maybe with the concurrence of my Black or something like that. And I'm trying to focus on the unanimity, the bringing together of the members of the court, where there were very serious divisions at times. And yet, when you seemed, and I'm asking you if my observation is true, and if so, whether you strove to make it this way, that when you got a case, and even I think the Fenestra case was one where everybody went along, and I have to check that out, but did you consciously, in your service on the Supreme Court, conduct yourself in some way to bring this about when in a lot of other cases that you did not handle, there were sharp and bitter and rancorous divisions?
Well, I really didn't change who I was, but I heard several of my colleagues say early in my service on the court that, you know, what you're here for is to give your individual judgment. And I didn't agree with that, as I told you. I think you're there to make decisions by unanimous, if possible, vote, but certainly by majority vote. And so I wrote to reflect my own view of the law, but also to reflect whatever inputs I could get from others who might discuss it. But I never asked anybody to join me in opinion. I don't think anybody ever did around there. When I was there, there was no politicking that I knew of on opinions. You'd write your material and send it around, and if they had anything to say about it, sometimes they would. They'd say, well, I don't like what you're saying here, and I can sign that if you want to restate that a different way, and you look at it and decide if that is a better statement of the law than what you have given, and if you think that it is, you would change it. If you think that what you said is what you really want to say, you leave it that way, and the person would then decide whether they wanted to sign it or write a separate concurring, or, as a last resort, concurring in result without opinion.